Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 53rd session of the Oklahoma legislature ended with either recriminations or sighs of relief, depending on your political viewpoint. Despite being the centerpiece of both the governor's and prominent legislators' agenda and having veto-proof majorities, the legislature was unable to find agreement on a cut in the state's top personal income tax rate. The reasons? Well, speculation is centered on a few different themes. For some, the cuts didn't go far enough. For others, the failure to remove special interest-oriented tax credits doomed the proposal as too drastic to the state's revenue picture. Still, others saw that the final version of the bill would actually raise taxes on middle-class taxpayers in the state. But what's interesting is what hasn't been mentioned that much, which, according to my guest today, was more telling. The groundswell of support for education, especially here in Tulsa, that in essence told legislators vote for more funding for education at the expense of tax cuts. Well, while the tax cuts failed, so did more funding for education. As noted in Sunday's Tulsa World column by Janet Pearson, one more reason, perhaps, for the tax cuts' failure was the excellent analysis provided by the Oklahoma Policy Institute and my guest today, David Blatt. Throughout the session, OK Policy provided sound economic data to rebut tax cut proponents' arguments. David Blatt joins me today on Studio Tulsa. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
In the wake of the Oklahoma legislative session, which I know your organization was very much vocal in opposing the tax cuts, which eventually failed in the legislature, let me ask you, in your opinion, what was the reason for these cuts failing?
Well, I think there were a number of things going on. Certainly, there was a lot of division within the leadership of the legislature and the governor's office.
And especially in the House, too.
Well, there was within the House caucus, there was conflict, and then between the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. I think there was a certain sense that once you had Republican control of all three branches, that you would see
And veto-proof majorities.
And in fact, having one-party control seems to have made getting certain things done even harder for those in authority than when you had divided government. Because if you think back to the mid-2000s, it was when Brad Henry was governor and the Republicans controlled the House that you saw tax cuts actually were enacted. So this year, there were some pretty deep divisions that emerged between the governor's office, the House, and the Senate. And ultimately, they ended up having irreconcilable positions, with the House and the Senate at the end having dueling press conferences on the second to last day of session, pushing their own plans and accusing the others of bad faith and abandoning deals. So I think that was one of the reasons. But at the same time, I think that ultimately the legislators listened to their constituents, and the constituents were not demanding tax cuts. We were saying during session that Oklahoma has 99 problems, but the income tax isn't one. And I think a lot of legislators were hearing concerns from their constituents about a whole range of things, but our top personal income tax rate of 5.25%, and most people pay closer to 3%, that really wasn't something that created any kind of grassroots fervor. So there was definitely a political imperative to push tax cuts, particularly after the governor got on board. There was some national pressure coming from national newspapers and think tanks.
The Wall Street Journal was.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But they weren't hearing at the grassroots level. I think what they were hearing was, after several years of serious, painful budget cuts, there was a real push now to take care of our schools, our infrastructure, public safety. Ultimately, they did make some progress in some of those areas, not others. But I think that the demands of providing adequate funding for services ended up trumping what was really a political and ideological push for tax cuts.
I know that you have talked till you're blue in your face about preserving education, infrastructure, social safety net, and public safety all session long. But it's interesting, I have not heard that coming out of the Capitol since this failed so much. I've heard of a variety of other reasons, and I can share some of them. The fact that they didn't get revenue from ending a lot of the business tax credits, that was a big key, that they were going to lose revenue that they hoped to accomplish through the elimination of business tax credits, which they just couldn't find the will to do.
Right.
Was that an issue?
That was an issue, but I think they were combined. From very early on, the Senate Republicans in particular kept insisting that any tax cuts must be revenue neutral because they acknowledged the need to at least protect funding levels for core services and hopefully actually be able to do some increases, which at the end of the day, they did do some increases for certain areas. And so when they started from the idea that any tax cut had to be revenue neutral, that any cut in the top income tax rate had to be offset by doing away with tax preferences, then it became much more challenging because the question would be, what tax preferences were you going to do away with in order to make this revenue neutral? And we heard all session long about the need to do away with special interest benefits. And a lot of these were business incentives that had their own constituencies. But what was often frustrating to us was that every time you actually looked at the bills to see what tax preferences were being done away with, they were not giveaways to corporations. They were, in fact, broad-based preferences for low and moderate income working families, things like the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit and the personal exemption. So very often when the rhetoric was about special interests, but the reality of the bills was that these were broad-based credits that are claimed by hundreds of thousands of Oklahoman households. And when you actually looked at these revenue-neutral proposals, they would have ended up raising taxes on anywhere from a third to a half of Oklahoma households.
And that was the big thing I heard, was that, in fact, the tax cut proposals would realize an increased tax burden on the middle class, and it would be, in fact, a tax increase. And that knowledge came pretty late.
Well,
in this
it was fascinating. You know, they worked.
Because you were
all
talking
session.
About it in January.
We were, although our concern was primarily over such things as the child tax credit and earned income tax credit and the sales tax credit that provides an offset for the sales tax on groceries. At the end of session, they came together with an agreement that I think everyone would acknowledge was not properly vetted. That they had some numbers and it looked good. What that agreement would have done at the end of session was limit eligibility for the personal exemption to families with income under $70,000 a year and also did away with a certain itemized deduction. So they actually at the end protected those low-income credits but created a situation where, well, some very low-income people would have ended up paying some additional money because of the way that they rearranged the lower tax brackets. But what ended up being, I think, most harmful for getting something passed is that if you made between $70,000 and $100,000 a year and you had several kids and you owned a home and itemized your deductions, turned out that you might be facing a tax increase in that case of somewhere from $100 to $250 more. And I think some of these legislators and even some of those who were pushing hardest all session, our adversaries in the think tank world, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs, looked and said, wait a second, this would be increasing my taxes. We can't be for that. So the House Republican caucus, when that came to light, they had a situation in the last week of session where the votes were not there. They could not pass the tax cut proposal that the House, Senate, and governor had agreed to. At that point, the House threw together a last-minute proposal. The Senate said, a deal's a deal. We're not renegotiating it. And things actually collapsed entirely. But I think all of that was based on the challenge that they had to come up with a plan that would try to be close to revenue neutral and allow them to at least maintain and restore certain funding that had been cut in recent years. And for that, we give real credit to leadership in the House and Senate that really did talk about the need to preserve funding.
Yeah. But getting back to this idea of not understanding what eliminating broad-based exemptions do to your taxable income, I mean, it just didn't seem like the legislature got the idea that if, you know, you take $5,000 that add to your taxable income at 5%, that offsets an awful lot of income at dropping the rate by 0.5%.
Exactly. So it did turn out that let's take that family making $90,000 a year. They would have had some portion of their income after you do away with standard, with the itemized deductions, and a certain amount of their income would have been taxed at 4.8% rather than 5.25%. But as you said, they would have had more taxable income. So some would have done better, some would have done worse. So we put out a post near the end that gave some examples of households who would do better, some who would end up doing worse. But I do think that in the eagerness to get an agreement that that plan was not properly vetted. But that happened all session. The governor put forward a plan, which she made the centerpiece of her State of the State address, and it went into a bill, House Bill 3061, that initially would have done away with all the exemptions and deductions that seniors and retirees can claim, that military personnel can claim, that veterans can claim. And it appeared that nobody knew that this was in the bill. And so once seniors and veterans and military people who are pretty well organized and vocal heard about this, they began contacting their legislators, contacting the governors, and the folks carrying the bill could not run quickly enough away from their own proposals to say, well, we don't want to do that. We don't. So it really ended up, the idea that they tried to pursue was, well, we're going to tax more income, but tax at a lower rate. But in fact, a lot of people would have ended up doing worse under almost every proposal.
My guest today is David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, okpolicy.org. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa as we talk about the whole focus of the, I think, of the legislature for the most part, which was on tax cuts and how it failed. Now, I want to talk about some of the other reasons that have been floated and see what you think about this. One of the things that was somewhat surprising to me that there was a constitutionality factor to some people, the fact that a tax cut that is, in fact, a tax increase on certain people might not be constitutional under State Question 640. What do you think of that argument? Is that seems a little dubious to
me. Well, it's still unproven, but I think it's actually a real line of argument. So to remind your listeners, under State Question 640, a revenue bill must meet certain qualifications. It must be passed by a three-quarter vote of both legislative chambers or a vote of the people. It also must be introduced in the House, and it can't be introduced in the last 5 days of session. So the big question is, what is a revenue bill? And the assumption has been that a bill that raises taxes overall is clearly a revenue bill. But there's a whole number of areas where you have shades of gray.
I would think any bill that provides for revenue, fees, anything, could be considered revenue.
Fees is a gray area. If you have a tax in a bill that does something else, the state passed a provider assessment on nursing homes and hospitals, but within larger legislation, some have argued that that's not a revenue bill. But the question became, well, what if the bill is a tax cut overall, but it raises taxes on some? Is that a revenue bill? If it does away with tax exemptions, is that a revenue bill? What if it's just a straight tax cut? Is that a revenue bill? I know there are people who've looked at this who've made the argument yet, but it hasn't been directly tested in court, that even a straight tax cut bill would be a revenue bill under Section 10, Article 33, under State Question 640. I think there's a pretty good chance that had a tax cut bill gone through at the end of session, it wouldn't have been with the three-quarter majority. It would have passed in the last 5 days, so it would have, there would have been grounds to challenge it. I'm pretty certain that there would have been a challenge. It ended up being moot this year because none of the tax cuts actually passed.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see if we do pass a tax cut in the future, whether somebody actually makes that argument that a tax cut is yet still a revenue bill.
And I think what it did raise is the concerns that some people had about how our tax system can only move in one direction. We can cut taxes, but we have, because of constitutional obstacles, because of political obstacles, enormous difficulty ever raising them, regardless of the circumstances. And we saw in recent years, as bad as our budget situation became, and the cuts that we saw across all areas of government, there was really never any serious effort to raise taxes up. And that led some people with experience managing state affairs, from Lex Holmes, who was budget director under Governor Henry Bellman, to Scott Meacham, who was Governor Henry's budget director, Ken Miller, who is state treasurer, currently Republican, saying, we need to be really cautious here. And I think that when you initially had the governor and legislators saying, we need to enact a significant initial cut to the income tax and then put in mechanisms to ensure automatic cuts going forward, that struck people as pretty reckless because we don't know what circumstances are going to be like in the future.
I was surprised by the willingness to embrace these tax triggers where if revenue goes up in a variety of areas, and it was a little more sophisticated, I think, this time around than the last time, but the idea that if revenue goes up, you see an automatic cut, because the state just went through a situation where we saw, a drop of revenue of about 15-20%. We came back, five?
Mm-hmm.
And we had another tax cut.
Right. It's very hard to design a trigger that would work the way you wanted in all circumstances. So at the end of session, they were looking at one trigger mechanism that could have created a situation where you'd begin a given fiscal year, the economy could enter into a downturn, revenues can start falling dramatically, as happened in 2009, but you wouldn't have any way to stop the train. And basically what we said is it puts the plane on autopilot, and sometimes you can see the disaster up ahead, but there's nobody who is able to gain control and reverse course. So we were arguing that trigger mechanisms are not the right way to go. There was a group of about 30 bipartisan business and civic leaders who also said, you know, we have different positions as to whether there should be a tax cut now, but we shouldn't be deciding future tax policies today because there's so many possible unforeseen circumstances, both on the economic side, but also in terms of what the budget needs of the state are going to be. If next year the legislature decides that a tax cut is the right policy, we'll probably be arguing against it, but they have every prerogative to make that choice. But to decide today what the right tax policy is should be in 2-5, some of these were going 10 years or longer down the road, seems to us just an abdication of the responsibility that legislators properly should have.
Yeah. I'm going to ask about another reason why these tax cuts failed this year, and it's from a faction of probably both House and Senate Republican caucuses, that it didn't go far enough.
There were some who made that case. I don't think at the end of the day when they were whipping the votes and seeing who was there, I don't think that that was decisive. But there were certainly some who early on were pushing for the total elimination of the income tax. And we had a study that came out authored by economist Arthur Laffer being pushed by the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs. And you had legislation that would have put that study's proposals into statute for the gradual phasing down of the income tax over a 7 to 10 year period. And people pushed that hard. And even during session, when it became clear that those more radical proposals were losing momentum, you had people saying, keep pushing, we need to shorten the fuse and double the powder. By the end of session, it was clear there was not going to be an elimination of the income tax. At that point, I think most of the tax cut proponents were, in fact, willing to take just about anything, and at the end of the day, they couldn't get even that.
Well, let's talk about the budget that passed. What is notable, despite education really mobilizing this year to ask for more money in the budget, there's really very little money for new money for education.
We saw overall state budget was an increase of a couple hundred million dollars over last year. Some of that money, a good portion of it went to transportation because they had done some bonding, which created a hole that needed to be filled. So there was $100 million more for transportation. There was about $50 million of additional money that went to DHS, which I think most people applauded. Money for implementation of the child welfare reform plan, the Pinnacle plan, as well as some provider rate increases, additional money as is needed almost every year for the Medicaid program to deal with their enrollment growth and utilization and healthcare costs. But at the end of the day, they didn't find really a single additional dollar for public schools, despite, as you said, parents and educators here in Tulsa in particular making very clear that the cuts over the last 3 or 4 years have really created a crisis situation in our schools. If you look statewide, state support for public schools, money that goes to the state aid formula from the state, is down by over $250 million, about 15% in the last 3 years. At the same time, public school enrollment is up over 20,000 students. So we are seeing larger class sizes. We're seeing fewer course offerings. We're seeing the elimination of programs. And yet the legislature decided to prioritize other spending demands and also still to prioritize tax cuts, because they did put $30 million aside for the tax cut that never actually happened. Even when it was clear that the tax cuts were dead, there wasn't the will to reallocate that money for schools.
Mm. It would be very interesting to see if they make some sort of adjustment at the beginning of the next session, because they're likely to have some money in the rainy day fund as a result. Do you think?
There will certainly be a large deposit in the rainy day fund this year. There was a large deposit last year. So the rainy day fund is going to be up around $500 million after this year. You can appropriate a quarter of the rainy day fund on the declaration of an emergency. The recent experience has been that there's a reluctance to tap into the rainy day fund other than when you actually are seeing revenue shortfalls. But if they come back next session, assuming that the economy stays strong and that revenues continue to come in at or above projections, I think there will be an opportunity to make a supplemental appropriation. The problem for school districts in the Tulsa area around the state is that there's absolutely no assurance of that. So they're going to have to make these decisions about how many teachers to hire and which programs to run on the assumption that there's not going to be any additional money. So there may be some advantages to a supplemental next year once they're back in session, but I think most of them would have said that they wanted some additional money. The superintendent called for about $75 million more. Advocates in the Tulsa area said, you know, they need $50 million. And they ended up getting not even a buck and a quarter.
My guest today is David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, as we talk about the recent end of the Oklahoma legislature session, in which tax cuts failed, but basically a flat budget except for a few areas. And still you see a lot of state agencies that are much leaner than they were prior to our downturn in 2008. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. One of the things that all the proponents of tax cuts said, this is, we're coming back next year with a new proposal. Is there anything besides an income tax cut that might make more sense and might actually have more political backing? And I keep thinking of some sort of sales tax relief for groceries. This is something everybody buys, whether you're poor, whether you're middle income or high income. You buy groceries.
Right.
This would be and this would help low-income people as much as it probably would help high-income people.
I think that's an interesting thought. You hear people from both political parties say that we shouldn't be taxing groceries, that it is a shame for Oklahoma to be among a half dozen states that tax groceries. Now, we do provide a low-income offsetting credit if you make up to $50,000 a year, but I think that doing away with the sales tax on groceries would be very popular. It does raise some questions for municipalities who depend on sales tax.
Well, that's what I was saying. Maybe you just get rid of the state tax on groceries. And because municipalities, if you're in a small town, the grocery store is probably one of your biggest
right.
sales tax providers.
And traditionally, municipalities have fought this, but folks have suggested that there are ways to do this that would protect local government and cut the sales tax on groceries at the state level. I think that's an issue that should be on the table. Without question, there was important work done this session on tax reform, on cleaning up the tax code. We think the debate was ultimately too narrow, looking only at income tax credits, and in some sense too broad, because while they kept talking about those special interests I said earlier, when you actually looked at the bills, they were ended up proposing doing away with the child tax credit and earned income tax credit, which are really not special interest giveaways. But there are areas where you really need reform, whether it's income tax or property tax or sales tax. A growing part of our economy escapes state tax, whether it's online sales, whether it's sales of services as opposed to goods, whether it's ways that corporations are able to shift income so they exempt themselves. The gross production tax is a major revenue source, but we have a huge, huge problem with gross production tax, and that is that 20 years ago we started exempting horizontal and deep well drilling when these were new, expensive, untested technologies. Now, almost all the drilling in Oklahoma is horizontal or deep well drilling, and yet we're not taxing it.
It's a boon to the economy. Yeah.
It is a boon to the economy, but this is a mature, profitable industry, and yet we have a situation where we are only taxing horizontal drilling at 1% for a period of 48 months, even after they've paid back the costs of production. So that's an area where we really do need to look at, where there are, without question, special interests at work. But at least in the case, if you're talking about oil and gas, on other areas you can say, well, if we do away with some of these economic development incentives, companies are going to move out elsewhere. Well, the oil and gas isn't going anywhere. And there are, as far as we know, there are no areas with large reserves in this state or in this country that is not being drilled because the oil and gas industry are not receiving ample incentives. So we can have, I think there should be a debate there. There needs to be a debate about taxing services, about how to capture tax on online sales, lots of areas that could, in fact, provide an offset to certain tax cuts. We would say sales tax on groceries, stretching out the brackets so that you don't hit the top bracket at $17,000, $15,000 of income, increasing the personal exemption, maybe particularly for low and moderate income people. There's lots of things that we can do.
Mm. It'd be interesting to see. What are you hearing from the Capitol now in the wake of the failure of this? I mean, as I hear it, it's been less about what a lot of progressive elements have been talking about. It says we really need to invest in education. We can't have a flat budget for education. I'm not really hearing that. I'm hearing that we're coming back for more tax cuts.
I think that it was pretty predictable that in the wake of the failure of this, that the governor and some legislative leader says we're going to come back at it next year. And I suspect there will be proposals. Whether it becomes as central a theme next year, you know, I think that politically this one was a tough one for the governor. She was a popular governor, made this a centerpiece of her agenda, had a bold plan in her words, a radical plan in other people's words, and she wasn't able to get it done. So I think she's going to have to decide whether this is a battle she wants to have next year. I think one of the things that will give them pause is that there wasn't this groundswell of support for tax cuts. And we heard this from legislators from both parties, that they were not hearing from their constituents that their income tax is too high and need to cut their income tax. So they have to decide whether they're going to make tax cuts a priority over taking care of education, over continuing to fund the child welfare reform plan, over providing raises to state employees who've in many cases have gone 5, 6, 7 years without increases. There's a lot of needs out there, and we have long-term issues relating to the aging of the population and healthcare costs and pension costs. There are huge needs. Oklahoma is underinvested in our core services for a long period of time, and that's why we certainly intend to be out there going forward saying that our priorities are to take care of these core obligations.
Well, we'll see what happens. David Blatt, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Rich.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. You can learn more at okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our past programs, you can listen online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search the site as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.